Hi, good evening. Welcome. Sorry, we're just a couple of minutes late. My fault. Was late getting here. But tonight we're having Lorna, who is talking to us about the Airbus, and I got an opportunity to hear her talk about the Airbus and see the Airbus when I was back at the AHG home office in April. I think it was, and for one of the Diamond the Jubilee events that we're having, and it's a fascinating what she's done. So I think you're in for a real treat. So take it away.
Thanks, Steve. Well, welcome everybody. I want to thank you guys for joining me tonight. Thanks to the AHG, of course, for giving me the chance to share the work that we do on the bus with all of you. So welcome to the Herb Bus. I mean, we're formally known as the Herbalista Free Clinic, but for some reason the Herb Bus just rolls off the tongue a little easier, and that's kind of stuck. So today I know we only have a little over an hour together, and I'm going to try to cram a lot of information into that, and going over some of the basics about the free clinic. We're going to talk about what we do on the bus, how we go about it, and especially why this type of service is so needed and how you might go about starting up healthcare initiatives like this in your own community. So there'll be hopefully a little time for Q&A at the end. So if I don't hit some of the information that you were hoping to learn, hopefully we can get to that then. So we're basically a traveling free clinic and classroom, and we provide herbal care to underserved communities. And the way things are in the United States is that we don't really have a lot of access, no matter, you know, what echelon you're from. You're probably going to, you know, if you have insurance, have a doctor that you can go to, but they're not going to necessarily have herbal medicine that they can prescribe to you. So there's not going to be a copay to see an herbalist, or, you know, just $5 for your generic herbal remedy. So while the Airbus does focus specifically on supporting our friends on the street, the homeless community, and other vulnerable populations, we also recognize that in this country, everybody is underserved when it comes to herbal care. We also realize that our 25-year-old bus, which you saw on the previous slide, can't possibly dream of rectifying this on their own. So we've also dedicated a lot of our time and energies to sharing the ideas and the systems that we've worked out that work for us on the bus with other herbalists in hopes that we can help them get over the hump of getting something like this off the ground. So I'm going to go through a few of the different things that we do on the bus and just start with our basic clinical services. One of my first teachers was the late Michael Moore, and he would always call himself a generalist. And he meant by that that as an herbalist, he was a botanist, and he was a wildcrafter. He was a teacher, a medicine maker, a clinician, all these things. And the bus is a bit of a generalist too, we like to think. So one of the basic things that we do is make regular clinical rounds, and this is in the Atlanta area where we're hubbed, where we're located. So these services are by appointment, and as general practitioners, we work with our patients on both chronic and acute complaints. We also offer follow-up care at these clinics, meaning that we're not just going to see somebody one time, but we're going to have a regularly monthly follow-up with them so we can really partner with them and we can help guide them along their path to finding the health that they wish to achieve. So you can see a little shot of our clinic set up there. We're at the Open Door Community in their back parking lot. Inside the bus is where the apothecary is located, and I'm outside sitting with one of our patients doing an intake. So in addition to clinical services, obviously we're going to be dispensing the herbs also. So that's a shot of inside the bus. That's our herbal apotheca. And I guess I should probably clarify apotheca before I go further. In the state of Georgia, the term apothecary has actually been taken by the pharmaceutical board. So basically, you have to be a licensed pharmacy in order to use the word apothecary. So I'm actually the great-great-granddaughter of a German apotheca, and that's the German word for apothecary. And so I just felt, let's just get on with it. We drive a VW bus anyway. That's a German vehicle. We might as well just use that word and not worry about all the rules there. So you can see the apotheca inside, and there's a couple of our apothecaries sitting there. That's Todd on the left, and that's Amanda on the right. And they're both wonderful herbalists in their own right, great apothecaries. And they also bring something else to the table. Todd is a vet tech, and Amanda's also a nurse. So it's really important for us on the bus that we acknowledge that most of our patients are coming to us with an understanding of conventional Western medicine, and we want to be able to offer collaborative care and, you know, work with along with that system. So we do keep a lot of resources on the bus because, you know, someone might come with a diagnosis that I'm not familiar with or on a medication that I'm not familiar with. We have those resources, but Todd and Amanda are also amazing resources for that. So in addition to the regular clinical services for chronic care treatment, we also do pop-up first aid stations around the country. This is a picture of the Florida Earth Skills Gathering, and that was this past February. We've worked at Rainbow, helping out Sevensong when he does the calm station there, and we also have for the last several years worked at the Southeast Women's Herbal Conference, providing a station there to help support the women who go and attend that conference. And working these stations is a really amazing experience, and I would encourage, you know, any of you who are interested to try to get involved if you can, either at a gathering that's close to you or even one that's far away so you get to meet a lot of new plants along the way. And I know that in our herbal trainings, we often put really great emphasis on getting to the roots of conditions and figuring out tonic therapies. And sometimes we almost look down on, you know, quote unquote, band-aids, because a lot of times we see the conventional system doing that, just tamping down a system and not really addressing the root cause. But band-aids are important also. You know, when someone's in pain, it can be really hard for them to turn that corner and get the energy even to try to address their chronic issues. So when you work a station like this, you get to deal a lot with pain. You get to deal a lot with these acute situations and try herbs on them and see what herbs work. And then you see, like Sevensong always says, herbs not working, and that's just as informative as well. So it really is a great experience to learn better use of your materia medica, and also it's a great chance to learn from other herbalists. You get to do a lot of skill sharing because herbalists will come together from other places, and you'll be collaborating alongside with them, trying things out, watching them work, and a really great skill share experience. So this is another one of the pop-up clinics. This is at the Southeast Women's Herbal Conference, and that's a little Herbalina right there, the daughter of one of the workers at the clinic. And the Southeast Women's Herbal Conference is really a special weekend and a really great clinic. You know, a lot of the feedback we get when women come to us with issues or with their children, if they're having some problems, is that not only were they really grateful that this kind of care was available to them, but it also gave them that opportunity to experience herbs working. And that can be like an open door, just allowing them to walk through and to come into, you know, what herbal care can mean for them in their lives. So like I said earlier, one of the really important parts of our mission, probably one of the most important pieces, is herbal education. So the bus does focus a lot of its energies on spreading the word, on not only doing things like plant walks or, you know, mini first aid workshops, but also on teaching the method of the bus, just like tonight's presentation. So we've been traveling around the country a bit, visiting other herb schools. We were just in April up in Virginia at Sacred Plant Traditions with Kathleen Meyer and her students. In February, we were down with Bob Lindy in Florida. And when we go to these schools, you know, we're going to get the chance to work with students who have been studying herbs for a long time and are really looking for ways to apply them in their lives. And I know a lot of people who are on this herbal path are on it because they want to help. They want to help members of their community, and they're really excited about being able to do that, but don't necessarily know how to get there, or might be daunted by things like legalities or things like finances. So hopefully some of the things we go over today will help you realize that it is doable. It's really possible. So part of that herbal education piece, obviously the bus can't go everywhere all over the planet. So we also offer training manuals. And these are PDF files that are downloadable from the website. They're free. I really encourage you guys to take a look if you're interested. A lot of the information that's in this webinar tonight are in those manuals, but also a lot more. A lot of examples of forms that we use, safety and sanitation procedures, materia medicas, all that good stuff. So this is the one, the Herbbus Service Manual, that we'll be focusing on mainly tonight, but we actually have a few manuals on the website. So I'm going to talk really briefly about those other two, and then we'll come back to the Herbbus Service Manual. So one of the other ones is the manual that's been compiled over the years to help us with the Southeast Women's Herbal Conference. So this manual focuses more on first aid, since that's what we're providing at this clinic, and also our kits are geared a lot more towards remedies for women and remedies for children, obviously. This particular conference takes place in the fall, so there's also a lot of emphasis on the needs that people have during that change of season. And this is the third manual that we have. This is the foot care manual, and this one's pretty special to me. I've spent the last 8 years working at the Harriet Tubman Free Foot Clinic at the Open Door Community. And this is truly a collaborative care clinic. We definitely use some herbs there, but we also use some conventional therapies. And we happen concurrently with a free medical clinic that is hosted by Emory Medical School that's across the hall. So there's definitely a lot of give and take between the two clinics. We might have someone visiting us who we feel really needs to see a doctor to look at a specific condition, and we can make that happen. Or they might have someone that they think needs some care from our clinic, and they'll send them across the hall to us. So in this foot clinic, in this foot manual, you'll see all kinds of information from, again, sanitation and safety procedures, which are really important, as well as specific protocols for different foot situations, foot issues, a pretty big repertory, a lot of the formulas for things that we use in the clinic. And you can see a picture of the clinic there at the top of your screen. This clinic is every Wednesday night, and it's a few hours in the evening. We see between 15 and 20 people, depending on the number of volunteers we can wrangle for the night, because it's all volunteer run. And that night was actually a pretty busy night. I think we've set up about 8 stations running at that time. And then hopefully y'all's stomachs can take it, but in the bottom there, that's just a before and after picture of one of the feet that we worked on. And that was just from one session. So it really is amazing work, and it's incredible what you can do for someone in just a really short period of time, just giving them a little bit of care. So that, again, is also available on the website. So if you go to the website, there's an Herbbus website that would have a link directly to the Herbbus Service Manual. But if you were interested in these other manuals, they're all located on the Herbalista website, and that information will be at the end of the webinar. And finally, obviously we offer tea. I mean, what herbalist would call themselves an herbalist if they didn't force tea on folks at all times? So here you can see our little tea station. This is at the Herbbus Clinics. And we try to put together a seasonal tea, something that tastes good, something that's supportive of what the people's needs would be during that time of year. And this is something that they can enjoy while they're waiting for their appointment. And it's a chance to get a little bit more herbs into people. We often try to put a lot of nutrient-rich herbs in there as well. So now we'll get more into the nuts and bolts of the clinic. So we're going to do an exploration now of our basic protocols, how we set up the clinic, how we select stations, service the stations, how we schedule the patients. We'll also go a little bit into some of the apothecary concerns and the forms that we use to keep track of everything, and our kittage, how we stock the bus. So again, there's that free PDF if you want to learn more. And you could check back often, because we do regular updates to it. Because as we provide these services and work with people, you know, we realize that there are better ways of doing certain things, and so we're constantly changing and evolving. That's part of being a good herbalist, I think. of being flexible and being able to change with changing needs. So the Herb Bus crew, right now we generally, when we run a clinic, there are three people who will staff that clinic. And that doesn't include the station host. They're a bit of a separate entity. So I'll go through each of those positions and kind of describe how we find works really well. So one of the most important people of the whole thing is the station hosts, and they are really the bridge. They're the person who connects us with the community that we're trying to serve. So it's very helpful if that station host is someone who lives with the community that we're trying to serve or works in the community that we're trying to serve. There's a lot that we're trying to make happen, and some of the people that we're trying to help are hard to reach and hard to be in contact with. So the station host, if that's a person who is already embedded in that environment, then they're going to really easily be able to know who needs help. They can generate the patient list for us, and they can also help us, you know, solve any problems that arise. They're also going to be the ones who make sure that we have the spot that we can pull the bus into. They're going to make sure that we have restroom access, and they're also going to make sure that there's a power cord that we can plug into. The power is not absolutely necessary, but since the bus can plug in, it is pretty nice. That way we can, you know, run other things if we need to. So our tea dispenser, we plug that in. Sometimes we might need to plug in a grinder or something like that. So the other couple positions would be the herb medic. That's going to be your person who does the intakes. They're going to make the assessments when they meet with the client, and they're going to create the formulas. It's really their responsibility to be extremely familiar with all of the medicaments that are aboard the bus. You know, you can't blend a formula with something you don't have. So that herb medic needs to be really familiar with all the kits that are there, everything that's at their disposal, and so that they can use it best. And they also, when they make the recommendations to the patients, they need to be really aware of what's practical and what's doable. So someone might really need an herbal tea. That might just be the perfect thing for them. But if they don't have access to a kitchen, that might not be the recommendation that you're going to make. So you really want to be pragmatic in that position. And then we also have the apothecaries. We find that it really takes two. They have a lot of responsibilities going on in the bus. You know, not only are they, you know, pulling out everything and getting all ready, but once the clinic starts, they are compounding all of those remedies and doing a lot of writing. You know, we have very clear labels that get written out and put on all the bottles, because when someone leaves us, that bottle is the only way they know what to do. You know, whatever's written on there is the information they're going to have. So the apothecaries have to have a really good handwriting. That's an important part. And they're also going to be tracking everything that we dispense. So there's a form that we'll look at later that's the dispensary form, and that's where they're going to be tracking everything that's gone out of the bus, and that helps us prepare for the next time. So usually it does take two. There's, I think, some photos that might show a little bit later the positions, but they sit on either side of that apothecary, and usually one apothecary does all the tinctures and all that compounding. And then the other apothecary sitting at the other side of the bus, they're doing the tea blending, and they're doing the essential oil work, and they're doing a lot of the dispensary list maintenance. So currently in Atlanta, we have two stations. And by station, I mean a place that we've made a really strong commitment to, and we're telling them that we're going to come and service them on a monthly basis. So this is probably why we only have two, because that's a pretty big commitment to say that every month we're going to come back here and we're going to conduct clinic and we're going to pour remedies, because that can start to add up. So right now we are servicing two places. On the left, that's the Open Door community, which I've talked about a little bit already. They're a community that is really dedicated to helping homeless communities and other vulnerable populations. They do a lot of work in the prisons and a lot of work with people on death row as well. And then on the right, that's the Big House. And the Big House is not located too far from the open door, it turns out, and they've become a bit of a community center themselves and work a lot with activists and artist communities. And the way I got to know them originally was when the Occupy movement was going on in Atlanta and there was the big encampment that was going on downtown. As a street medic, we were doing a lot of trainings to try to get other people trained up so they could help out with that work. And the area where the encampment was also was our really big homeless park. So the first aid station that was there was really not only supporting the Occupy encampment, but really dealing a lot with the homeless community and their needs. So we were doing trainings, and the big house opened their doors and let us use their area and facility for these trainings. So it's really nice to be able to support them when they support the community so much as well. So when you choose a station, there's a few things to consider. You want there to be restroom access, and that's both for the practitioner and also for the patient. You want there to be power, although that's not absolutely necessary. You want there to obviously be space, be room for you to do what you need to do. And you also want to make sure that there's a person who can host you, who can help be that bridge and make sure that it all comes together. So I would like to also stress that if you do, you know, pick a community center or a place that you want to go and provide these services to, you really want to be respectful of the protocols that community already has in place, especially when you're working with more liminal and vulnerable populations. There are certain things that community center might have had to establish, certain kinds of protocols that allows them to work with that delicate, like within that delicate situation. So you really want to respect it. I mean, they might say, well, these are the restrooms that you can use, but not these. And there's probably a reason for it. And you might not know that reason, but they have a reason. And so you want to, when you enter and approach and go to work with a community, you want to work within their protocols. So this is kind of an example schedule. Basically, when we pull in and dock somewhere, it takes us about a half hour to get set up and to brew up our teas. We can do it in less time, but you never know what you're going to encounter. There might be an electrical issue. Maybe the tent is, you know, giving us problems. And also depending on the weather, because we're kind of like the postman, like we're there rain or shine or cold or what have you. You might need to be setting up additional coverage for the people who are waiting. So sometimes we have to put up an extra tent as the waiting room to protect people while they're waiting, you know, or put out blankets for them, things like that. So once we get set up, we start clinical services, and we work between 4 and 5 hours. It depends. We would have been in contact with that station host, letting them know how long we were going to be able to be there that day, and they would have generated that patient list accordingly. We run clinical services, dispense all the medicines, and then we break it down. And it takes, you know, 15 minutes to a half hour for us to break it down again and pack it up. In that picture there, you can just see some of our kits and bins that are in the bus as we prepare to roll over to one of our stations. So when we do the setup, this is an image from a day that was a little bit drizzly and off and on. So there is a tent that comes out of the side of the bus, which is where the intakes take place. And then over to the left is a freestanding 10x10, and that's one of the ones that we set up when we need to have a little bit of a waiting room. You can see the tea station there that day. It's on a little brown table in the back. Again, the apothecary is inside, and people are just hanging out. Clinic can be fun, too. So when we serve a station, the number of people that we see is dependent on how many of those are first-time visitors to our clinic and how many are there for follow-ups or for refills. So if someone is a new visitor, we allot them 45 minutes. And actually, I'll probably get into that in the next slide here. Yeah, let me flip forward. Yes, here are my timings. So if someone is an initial visitor, we're going to schedule 45 minutes for them. That 45 minutes doesn't include the actual compounding. That's the time of the herb medic and how much time they need to do the intake and write the formulas. Then they pass that off to the apothecaries, and they start working on the compounding. The herb medic takes in the next client and continues work. So if someone is there for a follow-up visit, we schedule them 30 minutes. Now, it might take less time, which is fine, but we try to not let it go beyond that, because if we can keep things, you know, within their time limits, that allows us to see everybody, and we want to stay on time. So refills are kept on a separate list. Some of these stations, we've been seeing people for about a year and a half now on a monthly basis, and we know what's really working for them. And so they might have a sleep formula that's just perfect, and they might just need a refill and not actually need to see the herb medic. So they are on a separate list, and they approach the apothecaries directly, hand in old bottles, because we do sterilize and reuse our bottles, and explain, you know, what they need a refill of. And then the apothecary might ask a question or two and make some notes on their chart, and then they'll dispense that formula again. So as it stands right now, we're seeing probably between 6 and 10 patients, and then there'll be a few others that are there for refills. So we're starting to pour more and more medicines. The more we do our follow-ups, we get, you know, more people bringing in new, other people get moved to just follow-ups, and then people coming for refills. So when we do a pop-up first aid clinic, it's different timings. Obviously, that's not scheduled. That's just for walk-ins. You know, anybody can show up. And then also I have written their herb card. That's actually a new project, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. It's also a first aid project. For that, we have just a sign-in sheet. People come in, we sign them in, and work with them in the order they come. So this is a big crux of what allows us to provide the services that we do. I like to make up words by putting AGE on the end, so I'm going to talk about formage now. These are basically all the different kinds of forms that we use, and I think forms are a really great resource. Forms are something that allow you to, you know, do the best work that you can do. So they can remind you of what's going on at the moment, such as an intake form, reminding you of questions that you should be asking, making sure that you didn't forget to check a certain system. They also remind you of what's happened before. You can look back at previous forms, you know, in their file and see what happened last time. What was the formula we had them on last time? And they also help us plan for the future. So that would be like our Apotheca forms, the dispensary list, which that's actually a photo of on the right side there. By tracking what we've given out, we can actually, when we do our return visit the next time, know what we poured a lot of. You know, maybe at this one particular station, we're pouring a lot of skullcap. We'll know to make sure that we're fully stocked with that when we return. So forms can be really helpful. So for patient forms, we have two kinds of intake forms. We have the initial intake form and the follow-up form. Pictured there at the bottom left, that's the front and back side of the initial intake form. It's only two pages. I know that when I first started out, I think my first intake form was probably like 25 pages long. That might be a bit of an exaggeration, but it was pretty long, maybe 13 pages or so. You know, I was asking all kinds of questions. And while I think it is important to be really thorough, we also have to be pretty precise and succinct if we want to get through this intake in the 45 minutes that we've allotted. So we've pretty much distilled this down to what we think are the most important questions to ask. You know, we're obviously asking them, you know, are you on any medications? What is your main complaint? Things like, can you do remedies prepared in alcohol? You know, what are your allergies, previous diagnoses, medical history? You know, and then we get into some basics like, what does your diet look like? What does your digestion look like? What is your sleep like? Some of those real basics, and hopefully, you know, through this process, we're eliciting a lot of the information that we need. I also do some specific diagnostics. I check pulses. I look at tongues, and there's places on the chart for me to make notations about that. The follow-up form is pretty similar, except for the page one, the front side is just a bunch of blank lines. So, you know, I can write in whatever I need to, you know, going on the previous work. And then the back side, the only way it really differs is there's also a section for tracking. You know, whereas when someone came to us last time, they might have ranked something at a certain level, like my pain is an 8. Well, in that tracking section on the follow-up forms, we're going to be continuing that information. Like their pain was an 8 and now it's a 4, or their pain was an 8 and now it's 10, you know, which hopefully it's not happening that way. On the right side there, you see our script pad. So every time we write a formula, we're going to put it on that pad. This is something I got off Vistaprint, actually, and then I just modified it for the things that I felt were important to see and have. So obviously, there's a place for, you know, writing in the ingredients of the formula, and then how many, if it's a tincture formula, for example, over on the right, you're going to be putting how many mils of each of those ingredients, and hopefully at the bottom, those mils will total what they should have. So if it was a 4-ounce bottle, you're hoping at the bottom it totals 120 mils. There's a place for dosage. There's a place for specific instructions. We also have a place to remind ourselves so we don't forget when we're formulating. Like if they have a particular allergy, there's a place to write that in. If there's any contras that we need to be aware of because of medication, if they're pregnant or breastfeeding, there's places that we can circle that just to remind ourselves. And not only to remind the herb medic, but, you know, we're working on a team. The apothecars take a look at that when they start to fill it, and if they notice that we accidentally put something in the formula that shouldn't be there because the woman was pregnant, for example, they see that Preger is circled, and they can say, hey, wait a second, we should rethink that ingredient. So this is just a nice way to keep tabs on things and make sure that we're giving the best service we can to our patients. We also started using a little carbon copy pad book where we can write specific recommendations. In the past, we would write those out for them, give it to them, and then copy it down a second time on our intake form. At the bottom of the second page is a place for you to put your plan, like what you plan on doing and any recommendations that you would have made. So that was a lot of writing, and that was taking up a lot of time. So when I was in Kenya in March, I discovered these really awesome carbon copy books and brought them back. I mean, I'm sure they're here in the States too, but there they were right in front of me. And so we're using those. So we write out our recommendations. We can give them a copy, and then the other copy gets stapled onto the intake form. So after we've seen somebody, we have their intake form. Any scripts that we've written get stapled to that form. Any recommendations stapled to that form. And then every time we see them for their follow-ups, that intake then gets stapled to the top of it. So everyone ends up with this little file, this little bundle, and we can look right back through, and all the history is right there, right for us. So now I'll move on to our dispensary form. This is a really important form for us. It not only tracks the herbs that we dispense and allow us to know how much herb we're going through at a particular clinic, but it's also where we keep track of the number of patients that we've served. If they were new or if they were follow-ups, you can see that kind of scribbled at the top of the page. It also lets us estimate cost and track cost, which becomes important in the way we're running our Herbus project. We're invoicing back to our 501c3 sponsors to get our payment out for that. And I might talk about that a little bit later. But this does allow us to track cost. And it's also a place where we have our little wish list in the bottom corner. So that wish list is where when we're meeting with a patient and we go, oh my gosh, I wish we had, for example, I wrote their Eyebright, like we didn't have any Eyebright in our tea chest. So it's a place we can remind ourselves, like we really need this item included in our apothecary. And it's also the thing that we're going to look at before we do our revisit. So if it's the next month, as we're stocking up the bus, we always pull out last month's sheet and look at it and remind ourselves of what herbs we're pouring a ton of, what was on our wish list, what did we really want to bring for a particular patient at that station, so that way we can bring it. And again, this all goes to just providing the best care that we can for our patients. There I go again. We've got kittage now. So these are some of the herb kits that we use on the bus. And these are actually really fun to build. So whenever we do a little visit to one of the schools and do some of the herb bus trainings, we're always building kits for them. And it really is a lot of fun. So the three that are pictured here, these are, they're actually about to be our old tincture kits for the herb bus, because we're building some new ones right now that are even bigger and have bigger capacity, because we're starting to pour so much medicine at some of these clinics that this wasn't quite enough. So on the left, those are 1-ouncers. That is the kit that also doubles as my run kit. So if I'm doing first aid work, I can take that, stick it in my backpack, and make a house call, cabin call, tent call, whatever I need to do with that. In the middle, that is the tincture chest that holds 4-ounce bottles. So there's actually 5 rows, 5 columns of 4-ouncers, and then over on the very left, that first column, those are actually 2-ounce bottles of blends. So they're already in combination, whereas all the other bottles, these are all singles. And then over on the right, that is our tincture chest that holds 2-ounce bottles. There is 64 that can be held in that chest. So we really do have a pretty big Materia Medica to work with when it comes to tinctures. I don't know if it shows in this picture. Actually, it doesn't quite show, but if you go and look at the manual online, those charts that are on the back on the lid, that's how we can find our bottles really easily. They're also color-coded, so if it's in a green color, that's telling us that it's non-alcoholic. We do stock, I don't know, maybe 12 or so, 12 to 15 herbs in a tincture form that are either a glycerin or an apple cider vinegar tincture that we can use when we're working with someone who can't do alcohol. And this is really important to have that option. So sometimes we're working with someone, they can't do alcohol, and we're having one of those brainstorm moments. We can even just throw a glance at the lid and remind ourselves, what's at our disposal? What herbs do I have there that I can grab from to make this formula for this patient? And this changes all the time. You know, those are just tacked up there, those charts, with a little bit of glue stick, you know, on paper, because we're changing our minds sometimes. We're saying, actually, we don't really pour this herb very often, scratching it off, you know, writing in another one. And so we update these charts and stick new ones on kind of regularly. Also, as the seasons change, our needs of what to have in stock are going to change. These are a few more of our kits. On the left is a little travel trunk like your grandma probably had. And that's the pills and potions kit. So we have some different capsules in there, different combinations, some singles too, like milk thistle, for example. And that kit also doubles as a bit of a run kit. So in the top lid, there's this duct tape pocket. Duct tape's pretty amazing. Anyone who wants to do this kind of work needs to buy lots of rolls of duct tape. There's a duct tape pocket there, and we keep single-serve tea bags in that because those are oftentimes used as compresses in first aid situations. There's a few other things in that kit, such as probably the only two homeopathics that I carry. There's arnica pellets, and there's Trumule cream. There's also some electrolytes, just some different things like that. In the middle, there is our tea chest. It's actually not fully unpacked, so you can't quite see what's going on there, but in that tea chest is where we keep the scale, we keep a strainer, and that bag on the right, that also holds lots of single-serve tea bags. If you were to pull all three of those things off the top, you would see the rows and rows of single herbs in their individual baggies. Again, we keep a list on the top of the chest, detailing what's in the box, so we don't have to dig to know if we have something or not. And it also changes pretty regularly. And then on the right, that is our oils and aromatics kit. It also, you know, conveniently can hold those two little aromatherapy books that we use as references. There's the Julia Lawless book, and then the Aromatherapy for Healing the Spirit by Gabriel Moje, who I think has written a really wonderful book, great resource. So in the box, we have about 15 to 20 essential oils. We also have some infused oils, such as St. John's wort oil, calendula oil. We also keep some hydrosols, like rose water. We do use a lot of rose water. And sniffers. So those are the little containers for how we dispense a lot of our essential oils. Sniffers are like little inhalers, and they're great not only for just, you know, opening up the sinuses like an Olbus oil sniffer or a Vicks vapor rub kind of sniffer. But we also find that they're really helpful for working with emotional complaints and they've become really popular. People love the sniffers. So you can buy them as blanks and then just custom doctor them with whichever oils you want to use. Okay, and then this is our wound care kit. So this is also what I use at the foot clinic. It's my foot care kit as well. We have all kinds of things in there, from bandages to some of the foot tools. And then in that top little pullout container, that's where there are some of the creams and oils and tinctures and salves, et cetera, that we use for dealing with all manner of wounds. So importantly, what's also in here are things for safety. You know, there's packets of gloves in there. There's masks in there for when you need to use those. So it's really important to always consider those things when you're working with wounds. Obviously, it's not just about protecting yourself from that wound, right, because there's the open wound and you might get nervous about what's going on there, but it's also about protecting them from you. I mean, you're the one who's touching a lot of different people, and you don't want to spread things from one person to another person to another person. So it's very important that you change gloves between working with people if there was, you know, any kind of wound or bodily fluid involved, and that you work really hard to keep everybody safe. We also keep some things in there, like there's an eye cup you can see, there's one of those little suction bulbs, and some things like that. So here are some of the kits that we built when we went up to Sacred Plant Traditions. Notice the very funky duct tape. We really went for it. So we built two kits for them. On the left, which you can see displayed there in the upper left side, that's the tincture kit. We ended up making them a kit that combines both 4-ounce bottles in the back and then 2-ounce bottles in the front. And then on the right side, the blue topped one, that was their dry herb chest. So we had about 25, I think we fit in there, different raw herbs that we could use in combination. Here is another set of kits. These are ones that we built down in Florida at Bob Lindy School. And this was actually the first time that we had built kits for the school. Previously, when we'd run this workshop, which we had done with Corey Pine at the Blue Ridge School, those students simply worked out of our kits. It made sense at the time because that school worked with very similar materia medica to what we have on the bus. I mean, we're all from Appalachia. We're using all these same herbs. And I'd even done trainings with Corey Pine. I did a clinical internship with him. So I was really familiar with the herbs that he was used to working with. And so our kits were pretty easy for them to just adjust to. But that was really different when we went down to Bob Lindy School, because this is a Chinese herbal school. So they're working with powders, concentrated granules. They're doing ear seeding. They're doing moxibustion. So we really needed to build kits that they would feel comfortable working out of. You know, it's one thing to train them on a whole new model, but then at the same time to expect them to work with a whole new materia medica wouldn't have worked. So this was a lot of fun. We built about 4 different kits for them. At the top left there, that is their ear seed and moxa kit, which is a really cute kit. It even comes complete with a fake ear showing you where the different points are. The top right, that was the powders and concentrate granules kit. The bottom left is their dispensary kit. So that's an important thing to think about. If you're going to give out powders, what are all the different little things you need to do that? So included in their dispensary kit, there is a scale, the coffee filters that they weigh the powders out on, the little scoopers to give to the client, the bags to put the powder blends in, everything you need, little labels to write on, a pen to write on that label with. You try to think of everything you're going to need, because when you're out there, all you've got is what you have with you. And then over there, the bottom right is them setting up their different kits and making sure that we have everything together if we're running our free clinic that night. So obviously, I'm not very old myself. I'm in my mid-30s. I've been studying herbs since I got out of college, and there's just so much more to learn. I mean, it's such a big world. And it can be daunting when you go out there and you're expecting yourself to do an intake, make an assessment, and create a formula all in the span of 45 minutes. It's a lot of pressure. So I think it's really important for us to realize that we don't have to have it all in our heads. You know, that's why we're doing this together as a team. That's why we have other crew members that we can bounce ideas off of. That's why we have books with us. I mean, we have a whole little library crate that we bring with us, and we stock in that the books that we think we're going to want to turn to and look to find the information that we need. So we have herbal contraindications and drug interactions book, like you can see there. That's the older edition. There's a newer edition that's a little bit bigger and more complete, and we actually carry both because this older version I'm just really used to working with, but we do have the newer one as well. We carry different Materia Medica books. We carry a Merck manual. I really like some of the manuals that Michael Moore has produced, which are also available at his website. So if you want to get ready and do something like this, bring all your tools together. Grab all your resources. And I'm sure you'll be able to do good work and make people feel better. So I love that I wrote that. Free clinics ain't free. How's that for a college education? It ain't free. So this is the truth. You know, we're providing free clinics, and it's definitely free for the patients. They don't pay for anything. They don't pay for consultation. They don't pay for the tea. They don't pay for their medicaments. But it does cost us some money. We're dispensing a lot of medicines. We're spending time. We're keeping the bus maintained. We're using paper and ink to put out all the intake forms and the labels. So the bottles, it all does add up. So I'm going to talk a little bit about ways that you can help overcome some of these issues. We have found that what works for us right now is operating with some fiscal sponsorship. So we are not ourselves a 501c3, but we have partnered with a couple 501c3 organizations who act as our fiscal sponsors. So these organizations have their own mission. That's what makes a 501c3. They have to have a specific mission and a specific service they're trying to provide. So if you want to partner with them, you have to have matching missions. So we've been lucky and have found a couple of organizations who their missions were written in such a way that it matched the work that we were doing, so they can act as our fiscal sponsor. They give us a lot of support. They obviously give us some accounting support. They provide us with assistance with fundraising, and they also serve as the funnel for our funds. So we can solicit donations from people, from individuals, from companies, from organizations, and they can make those donations to our fiscal sponsors earmarked for us, and then it comes back out to our project. So it's been really helpful. You know, even though I don't like to think that you have to convince people to donate to a good cause, unfortunately that's sometimes true. You know, people are more readily going to write that check if they can get their tax break for writing that check. It probably also serves as a sense of comfort for them, you know, knowing that, oh, this is really legit. They have this 501c3 standing behind them. So that probably helps as well. So the fiscal sponsorship is really important. Soliciting donations is something that, you know, I'm not always that great at. I obviously, it takes a lot to ask people to donate to the work that you're doing. What I found works better is to just do the work, do the work, do the work, and people start to take notice of the work, and then they start wanting to donate. So that's what's worked for our model. But these donations can come from such a variety of places. Obviously, individuals, from friends, from family, from other organizations that have a really similar vision as yours. And all of these great companies in our healing industry. I mean, there's a lot of people manufacturing really great products these days. There's a lot of wonderful farmers out there. There are, you know, a big array of people that you can tap. You can let them know the work that you're doing, and they really would want to support. Because if you think about it, a lot of these companies got started out by herbalists. You know, they weren't only medicine makers. They were probably also practitioners at some level and really liked getting herbs to people and helping them. And maybe their company grew and grew to a point where that really was taking up all of their time. And they probably missed that, getting herbs right into the hands of people. So you're offering them, think of it that way, you're offering them a chance to get their herbs more directly to people who need them. one of the most important pieces of this, obviously, is also having a little chutzpah. You know, it is a little bit daunting. It's daunting when you start out. It's daunting as you're doing it. But if it's something that you're really passionate about and you really want to make a difference in people's lives and you've got a really strong vision, you can do it. It is just waiting for you to come do it, actually. But you can't really do it alone. So I'll just go through some of these bullet points here. Community healthcare really does take a community. You know, this is not something that you're going to be able to do on your own. You're going to need to find other herbalists and other medics who really share that same vision and they want to get together with you. And it's together that you can do it. When the Herbus first started and it was this little dream and I started, you know, building the kits and trying to figure out how to do it, one of the first things I did was send out an email to several of my really good herbal friends and then, can you guys help me with this? Are you guys interested in making this happen? And people showed up and they were into it and we did it. So you really do want to gather your troops, gather your friends, and together you can make something like this happen. The other thing that I think is really important is that you're continually building your skills. You know, we're never done learning. The more we learn, the better we're going to be able to serve. So, you know, keep building your skills. When it comes to where you can offer these services, you know, I think it's kind of funny. I often hear, you know, young herbalists or people just out of herb school having a difficult time finding clients. And there are so many people who need our help. Atlanta is full of them. I mean, maybe it's one thing if you live in a really rural environment and there's not as large a population around to serve, but come to Atlanta. We have limitless, you know, unending needs. So there are a lot of people out there who need your help. So you want to identify those populations. You know, maybe you're drawn to working with women who are in shelters, you know, battered women's shelters. Maybe you're drawn to working with the homeless. Maybe you're drawn to working with, you know, people in prisons. And there are ways that we're trying to figure out that we can hopefully get some herbs to people in the prisons. So identify those communities that have great needs. And then the next thing you need to do before you just jump right in there is you need to reach out to other organizations that are already active in those communities. So when I wanted to work, you know, with the homeless, the first thing I did was get in touch with the Open Door and start working with them at the foot clinic. So I embedded myself in a service that they were already offering and worked there for years. You know, I worked there for many years before I started the Herbus work and was able to bring the Herbus to them. So during that time, I'm getting more comfortable with the community. I'm understanding more about their needs. I'm understanding the ways that those needs are best serviced. So when I did decide to roll out the bus to them, I already had that connection. So there's a lot of organizations that are out there, and you know, I've listed a few of them here for you. There's shelters, community centers, food banks, but there's also local AHG chapters. I think I've heard from a couple other state chapters that they are trying to provide some of these services. So find out if there's an AHG chapter near you that is doing this kind of work, street medics, et cetera. And definitely volunteer at the centers to get an understanding of the terrain, and that will help you come up with the right model. Because when you decide to do this work, you're not going to just print out the Herbus manual and, you know, follow it page for page. It's going to look unique. It's going to be based on your experience. It's going to be based on your region. What are your medicines available? It's going to be based on the resources that are around you. What are the populations that need the help, and who are your comrades in this work? And it's going to be hopefully something that grows organically. So a couple tips to help keep it manageable is to start small. You know, you don't have to start with a lot. You could just simply start by bringing a wonderful herbal tea and serving that tea at a shelter on a regular basis. It's a small offering, but it gives you a chance to get some healing herbs into people's bellies, and it gives you a chance to make contact with the communities and to discover what their needs are, so then you can start to grow a project that can better service that. Definitely source from your local community. That makes it a lot more affordable. And make your own medicines. We've started getting some donations from companies of pre-made medicines, but in general, most of our medicines are ones that we've made ourselves. That's really the way that you're going to keep costs down. You obviously can't go buy retail and then give it out for free. You also want to reuse containers, and you want to get some good systems in place that makes you feel comfortable that you have properly cleaned and sterilized those bottles and those droppers, et cetera. On the website at the Herbbus, in the little blog role, there is a little article that we wrote on how we do our sterilizing. So definitely take a look at that if you're interested. But it also just takes a lot of time and elbow grease for sure, removing all those labels, et cetera. And, you know, get creative. I can't wait to hear more about some of the other clinics that are around and the work that they're doing, because it gives me lots of ideas. And, you know, we need to just share these ideas. And by sharing them, this kind of work can grow. So this is the latest project that we've started. It's called the Herb Cart. We've only rolled it out once. This was in April. We did a little kind of trial run. It was also at the Open Door, which you can see pictured there on the right. So they offer a soup kitchen on a regular basis at the Open Door, and so we decided that we were going to do a little mini pop-up first aid station during soup kitchen. Around, I guess in about 2 hours' time, maybe 150 men and women will pass through that line, through the soup kitchen line, and they'll get a little food, maybe a little drink. They also give out T-shirts. There's like a clothing closet. We also realized this was a great opportunity to get herbs to people. So there were four of us who went, and we had our little sign-in list, and I think we were only set up for about an hour, and we saw about 20 people in that hour, and it went really well. Obviously, it was a good learning experience. We realized what remedies we need to stock more of, what less of, how to keep things a little simpler so they can move quicker and we can see more people. Come this fall, this is going to be something that we offer regularly at the Open Door as well. And obviously, the reason that this work exists is because there really is a great need for it in this country. I'm the daughter of some wonderful, hardworking social activists, and they really raised me with the values that it's up to us to look out for each other. I mean, obviously, we would hope that our government does it, but it doesn't always. You know, right now there is a lot of battles going on about healthcare in this country, and it's not something that is given to everyone. Even though we're founded on certain principles like, you know, life and liberty and justice and pursuit of happiness and all of that, for some reason they decided that healthcare wasn't like the most important piece of that equation to make all those other things possible. So recently we've had a big battle going on in Georgia. This has to do with Obamacare. Basically, when Obamacare was passed, there was a Medicaid expansion that was one of the vehicles that would cover people who didn't have health insurance. There was a couple different vehicles. One was Medicaid being expanded to cover people in the lowest levels of income, so in the greatest poverty. And then the other vehicle was going to be tax credits that would be for people who were still of low income but a little bit higher. They would be able to get tax credits, which would reduce the cost to them for purchasing their own health insurance. So when this went before the Supreme Court, it was ruled that you couldn't force states to expand Medicare. So what happened, the result of this, was that we had a coverage gap. So if a state refuses to expand Medicare, which they've done in Georgia, we have a coverage gap. Basically, you are in this little donut hole where, because Medicaid's not expanded, you're not covered by them, but yet you're too poor to get the tax credits and get the help at the other end. So the Open Door community is really dedicated to protecting health for people. And they partook in a big demonstration down at the Capitol, along with a lot of other people. I mean, in the top left there's a picture of the current Reverend Ebenezer Church, which is where Dr. Martin Luther King used to preach, and basically went down to demand that they not deny this expansion of Medicare. You know, I don't know that it's going to go anywhere, but they were willing to put their necks on the line for it. And over there on the right, that's when they came home from their arrest. About five members of the House got arrested, you know, fighting for us, fighting for, you know, the health of our neighbors and the health of the people that are in our community. And so I want to say thank you to them for that. And I'd also like to say thanks to the community that supports all of this work and to all the people who have dedicated their lives, you know, sharing plant knowledge, nurturing the plants. There's a lot of people that I know that I personally feel great gratitude for helping shape and inform my work, and I know the other members of the crew on the bus feel the same way. So thank you all, and now I have this little final slide here that shows how you can find out more information if you're interested. So please check it out, and hopefully I'll get to meet some of y'all in the future somewhere on the road. So thanks, and can you see?
Oh, thank you, Lorna. You're doing some great work there. We only have one question that's been submitted so far, which is, where do you buy the great bags, boxes for your tincture kits?
So those come from a lot of different places. We definitely go to, you know, thrift stores sometimes. That's where some of the little cases, those little hard, I guess they're called like train cases or vanity cases. That's where those came from. But, for example, those really brightly colored duct tape cases from the sacred plant traditions, those are SKS containers boxes. So when you order empty bottles, they come in boxes. And so those are nice. They've got a lid, you know, a hinged lid to them. And also for the dividers, when you order in small enough quantities, it comes with little dividers like that. So you just cut them to the size of your box and fit it in. And then we just cover the whole thing in duct tape. And that way it lasts. It's more weather resistant. I've had a couple of my kits for many years. So, you know, you just got to get creative. Look around your house. See what you have. You know, some things come from office supply stores, the container store. Just look around. I'm sure there's plenty of fun stuff you can cover in duct tape.
I have another question that came in. She says, I see you have traveled outside of Atlanta. How do you decide where to go?
Well, we get requests, and so that's part of it. Obviously, a lot of the travel is either to service at particular conferences and gatherings, so it might be one that we're really interested in attending, so a lot of times there might be herb gatherings, or it would be to go teach at an herb school, and so the director of, you know, that school has made a request, and then we just look on the schedule and see if it's possible. So we have, you know, some trips coming up this summer. I'm going to be driving the bus out west, doing the rainbow gathering again, and then heading out to California, and hopefully we're going to be doing some workshops and clinics in both the Bay Area and down in Los Angeles, and then on the way home doing a little bit of work in Flagstaff, Arizona. And then this coming fall, I'm going to be sticking closer to home again and hopefully doing some workshops in the Tennessee area. There's been some requests from up there. So it just kind of happens organically as people make requests and we see if it can fit into the route, basically.
Well, I had a question for you, if you don't mind. And that is, you know, do you get enough donations to actually help fund supporting yourself, or do you have to support yourself in another way and donate your time?
It definitely began where it was me purely donating my time, because it took a lot of time to get this project off the ground. And now I would say it's starting to really work out where, especially with the teaching, I've been teaching herbs at a few different schools for many years now, as a medicine making teacher and field botany, et cetera. And So now getting to teach the herb clinic model has enabled me, by teaching these classes and helping people learn how to do this kind of work, is actually helping us fund the bus a bit, which is really exciting. But yes, I definitely wear a lot of hats and work a lot of jobs, you know, to make it all come together. But it's worth it. And as you find yourself doing the work and it helping people, you can't help but get all your juices fired up to come up with ways to fund it. So, you know, slowly but surely more donations come in. You know, we hold an annual fundraiser called Feed the Flame in the fall. And last November's fundraiser actually funded 4 months worth of clinics. So it is happening, slowly but surely.
That's terrific. I know Seven Song does a free clinic, and then he supports himself by charging for his classes. So I was just curious how you were working with that. Another question, how can a studying herbalist get involved with working you on some of these trips?
So there's obviously a few different clinics that I do. I would say that the foot clinic is something anybody can come and volunteer at any time. I mean, it takes a lot of volunteers to make that run. So that one is always an open door. Currently, the people who are working on the bus, they have all gone through basic training programs at Botanologos, which is one of the places that I teach at. So that was where I met. And then they started apprenticing at my sliding scale clinic, which is at my home, and doing some TAing. And then they got their seat on the bus, and we kind of went from there. So we're currently kind of fully crewed out. It is a pretty intimate situation when we're doing our regular Atlanta rounds, and there's, you know, we don't want patients to feel like there's 18 people standing around them staring. So pretty much to work those stations, you would need to be, you know, a member of the crew, and we're fully staffed, I guess I could say, currently. But that being said, this is one of the reasons I offer the workshops when I go to other schools, because at those workshops, we run clinics, so you do get a chance to work the bus. You get a chance to sit in the bus and be the apothecary. You get a chance to do an intake and try to work on your timing, that you can do that assessment and formulation in that time and make pragmatic recommendations in that time. So if you're interested in finding out about where the herb bus is going to be and what kind of workshops are going on, if you go to that second website, theherbalista.org, on the home landing page, there's a little newsletter sign up, and I send out a monthly e-newsletter. It's just once a month, I swear. And it lists the calendar of all the scheduled stops of the bus, like where we're going to be, what workshops are going on where. And that's a great way to tag in. Like I said, we'll be doing some workshops on the West Coast this summer and then back in the Southeast this fall. So if someone's interested from those regions, and you can also just get in touch with me, for sure.
Another person has asked the question, do you ever encounter difficult situations, such as violence or verbal abuse or anything like that?
Yes, definitely. You know, that we live in a violent world and a violent country, so there definitely have, you know, at times been difficult situations. But this is where that station host becomes really important as well. You know, when we're there doing the work, it's really nice to know that there's another person there helping create that safe vessel in which you can do that work. And that was something I learned through all my years at the foot clinic. We have, the foot clinic is indoors, and when we hold foot clinic, we have people who are on what's called house duty, and they're really in charge of making sure everything's flowing smoothly. They handle any difficult situations that arise, and even minor things, like this is the direction for the bathroom that you're looking for. And they've all been trained in de-escalation techniques, and that's definitely something that I think, you know, most clinicians should be practiced in. And so, you know, it's actually something that can be hard to find, that kind of training. You know, I know when Occupy was going on, that was definitely something that we were trying to get more formalized trainings for people on, and it was really hard to find people to give those trainings. But yeah, there will be difficult situations that arise, and you just, you know, keep your calm and try to maintain your integrity. And that's what I think works the best, when people see that you're really there for them in a real and a true way, they'll respond to that. definitely sometimes there have been people who are a little bit agitated and it can take a while to talk somebody down. But, you know, you do it. You take that time and you connect with them and you help bring the energy back down to a more moderate level.
Great. Well, that was all the questions. So thank you for sharing your information and thank you for the great work you're doing.
You're very welcome.
And for helping other people to get excited about extending that good work. So we really appreciate you.
Okay. Thanks so much, Steve. And by the way, Steve gave his wonderful new reference book. It's also Writing on the Bus. It's in our little library crate. So check out Steve's new book.
Oh, thank you. All right, everyone. Good night.
Take care.